Hello and welcome back to countries that don't exist anymore. This time we're returning to North America to talk about perhaps the most badass Native Americans to ever have stalked the prairies. They went from the whipping boys of North America to the scourge of the plains. They scared the Spanish, terrified the Texans, and put the willies up the Wichita. Anyway, we are talking about a people who called themselves the people, as most people do, but whose name to everybody else meant
men who want to kill me all the time.
But we are talking about the last great Native American holdouts against the encroaching Europeans. Yes, of course, we are talking about the Comanche and their empire of Comancheria.
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist anymore.
Where was Comancheria?
At its peak in 1836, Comancheria was about the same size as France, covering 240,000 square miles of mainly plains and prairies. But that wasn't your question. Where was it? Well, it was over five modern states of the USA: Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, and Oklahoma. The plains and prairie landscape were dry and featureless, with few landmarks. The treeless plains were thought of as a green, vast ocean, and was called the Great American Desert by soft European settlers who used to things like trees and mountains and maps, with helpful arrows saying things like,
"You are here."
Yes, like a theme park mini-map. Their lands were famously inhospitable. In the summer, superheated winds would strip the moisture from your face. In the autumn and winter, freezing northern winds brought driving rain and lethal blizzards. And this was probably a good thing, since it left the Comanche relatively contact-free with the Europeans.
Yeah, for most people's contact with the Europeans has been a bad thing.
Well, I mean, yes, on the one hand, there's slavery, disease and genocide, but on the other hand,
they do good bread.
Even by the mid-19th century, most Comanche hadn't been too bothered by Europeans, since they hadn't been decimated by smallpox, cholera, and the other exotic diseases that had ravaged other groups of native peoples. And while we think of Native Americans holding their lands for thousands of years, this is highly inaccurate. These tribes and peoples migrated and fought each other like other human beings, and this was especially true of the Comanche. As with the Inca...
Listen again to the Inca Empire episode, Series 1, Episode 5.
The Comanche's vast lands weren't some ancient ancestral homeland that had been theirs for all time. While the European settlers had been pushing west, the Comanche had been doing their own empire building, conquering and subduing 20 other tribes.
So Comancheria was like a real empire and everything?
Well, obviously, when we say empire, it's not like...
Oh, Comanche, Comanche, all the place.
There was no emperor or government apparatus or legal framework or anything like that. And even the Comanche weren't one united nation. In fact, the Comanche were made up of five groups called bands. These consisted of the Penatuka, Yamparica, Kotsoteka, Kahadi and Nokomi.
Penatuka, Yamakira, Kosoteka, Kahadi, Nokomi. Now you know, these are the bands of Comanche.
No, we're not doing a song. We're not doing a song about that.
Oh, well, damn.
Anyway, we already recorded that song for the Fourth Roman Republic. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And I like to keep things fresh on countries that don't exist anymore.
Oh, yeah, fresh. What, you mean with the same three bottom references and catchphrases like, everybody wants to be the Roman Empire? It's not exactly full of fresh ideas, is it, Ed?
Okay, point taken. How about we bring back Mappatron?
Ooh, Mappatron, that was good. Oh, no, we've already done the location bit already.
Legend.
Oh, great. Another bottom quote. That should be relevant to at least 10 of our listeners.
Still a majority.
True.
Oh!
So, definitely not a centralised nation, but the Comanche had a collective sense that they were the same people. Bands were friendly to each other and never fought each other. Each band had two chiefs, a war chief and a peace chief. Like the Roman consuls.
Everybody wants to be the Roman Empire.
But the chief wasn't hereditary and was there on the basis of popular support and merit. Really, anybody could be war chief as long as they had an idea of where to go next.
Oh yeah, like anybody can make a bunch of drunk Brits walk anywhere as long as they know where the open kebab shop is.
Exactly. Each band lived in a different part of Comancheria and so had different levels of contact with the European outsiders. The Amparica, Kotsoteka and Nokoni had stayed out hunting buffalo in areas that white men had never been. White men. White men. Hello, we're the white mans. We live next door. We're gentrifying the neighbourhood. But yes, this is an area that white men had never been. The Kahadi had traded with the Spanish, but only via Comancheros, who were like the middlemen between the Comanche and the Spanish. But we'll come back to them shortly. The Panatucas lived closest to European settlements. They had lived in the area where the buffalo had departed and so had resorted to trade with other tribes and white settlers to get by. The Panatucas were often Europeanized, wearing cotton rather than skins, using relatively modern implements like metal kettles and other knickknacks. They often spoke English or Spanish, and they were generally more comfortable with Europeans, even turning up to white settlements at mealtimes, expecting to be treated like guests and fed. Of course, the downside of this was that they were ravaged by smallpox and cholera, and often held at arm's length by the other Comanche bands.
Who were the Comanche, and where were they from?
Well, for a start, the Comanche didn't call themselves the Comanche. They called themselves Nermina.
Nermina. Nermina. Nermina.
Which is a word in the Shoshone language and just means the people. The word Comanche is actually a Hispanicized version of a word from the Ute people, who obviously had a rough time since Comanche just means the man who wants to kill me all the time. It's a bit like...
What's your next door neighbour's name again?
Man who parks in my space.
Oh, I thought he said his name was Keith.
Well, it's not. And the Comanche proved themselves to be lethal fighters, especially on horseback. If you're thinking of the Comanche as mighty Native American braves wearing huge feathered headdresses, think again. The Comanche generally wore black paint to signify death, and only adopted feathers later. They were also described as short, dark-skinned and barrel-chested. Which seems like a bit weird and problematic for me to point out. I mean, it's not like we'd say the French were all...
weird-looking pointy dudes dressed in stripy T-shirts, wearing strings of onions, chomping on garlic and going, oh-hee-haw, hee-haw.
Exactly. That's exactly what we wouldn't say.
Yeah, we wouldn't say that.
Wouldn't
That's
say
we
that.
Wouldn't say it.
But I guess the point is that their dominance of all peoples around them would make you think you were dealing with huge Native American Viking guys. But not at all. The Comanche often seemed far less physically imposing than other peoples they dominated. I guess they seemed unlikely conquerors.
So, why were the Comanche able to dominate over other Native Americans?
Well, for most of history, they really didn't. Up until the 17th century, the Comanche had mainly stuck to the lifestyles of their ancestors who had crossed the land bridge from Asia to North America. They hunted with stone weapons, usually hunting either rodents, small game, or buffalo, which they would only catch by causing a stampede, by burning the land, or herding them over cliffs. The Comanche also travelled on foot, or would ride around in a simple sledge pulled by a dog.
Hey, nice dog sled. Yeah, so how many miles to a bone do you get from that little puppy?
Right up to the 17th century, in fact, the Comanche hadn't, quote-unquote, advanced much at all. Unlike other peoples of North America, they really didn't do pottery, didn't build houses, or even cut down trees. They lived in skin teepees and didn't seem to have anything like a priest class or warrior elite. They hadn't even been any good in a fight, and had generally been driven out of territory after territory by much stronger peoples. All around them, the indigenous peoples of the North Americas were doing their thing. The Aztecs were urbanized and sophisticated. The Iroquois had a stratified class system. The tribes of the southeast had a maize culture with large urban centers. The Missouri, Omaha, Pawnee, and Wichita were variously brilliant with pottery, basket spinning, weaving. They were masters of farming and house building. So, outwardly, the Comanche seem to have taken the attitude of...
Why bother, mate?
Yeah, the Comanche got an F in all these skills, but the Comanche got an A+ in something else that massively tipped the balance in their favour.
Media studies.
No. The Comanche's fortunes totally changed when they got their hands on a piece of technology that transformed everything. And they mastered it like no other society since the Mongols. We're talking about... the horse.
Countries that don't exist anymore's history of the prairie horse. Before Europeans came to the Americas, there were no horses. It was the Spanish conquistadors that brought them over, giving them unparalleled mobility. And by accident, the Spanish horse was perfect for the plains and prairies of southern North America. Bred for desert conditions and an ancestor of the Arabian horses that the invading Moors brought to Spain, the Spanish horse was small and fast and able to go without water for days at a time. So giddy up, Mr. Ed, and make for the west.
Some tribes, like the Apache, saw the Spanish using horses and thought,
oh, that one.
So stole some of their horses. They also stole Spanish horse culture, including bits, bridles and saddles, and mounting from the right. This whole Indians riding bareback thing in Wild West movies, nope, not a bit of it. When it came to riding culture, the Apache imitated the Spanish closely. So the Apache may have been one of the first native peoples to swipe the horse, but they didn't use it to its full extent. A bit like Saxon warriors, they'd hop on the horse for a travel, but once they arrived where they were fighting, they'd dismount and only fight then. But the mobility the horse gave them was a total game changer, and they used this new tech to make long distance raids, generally on the villages of the Pueblo Indians that were allied with the Spanish. And the outcome of these raids? Horses spread across the North American continent. Apparently unable to rely on their Spanish overlords for protection, the Pueblo Indians revolted against the Spanish in 1680, destroyed their buildings and released thousands of Spanish Mustangs into the wild where they bred and multiplied. End result? Horses for all, but only if you can catch one. And this totally changed the Native Americans of the North American continent. In 1650, no American Indian had ridden a horse. By the 1750s, pretty much every tribe in the South had horses. And that led to some serious jockeying for position.
Edward O'Mara, the Court of Podcasts finds you guilty of dreadful jokes. How do you plead?
Well, how about, Your Honour? Nay contest.
Take him down.
Why was riding horses such a big deal? Isn't that just what posh people do on the weekend? Do they win rosettes or what?
Well, we've already talked about the raiding advantages, but there are other reasons why tribes that adopted the horse started to dominate tribes that didn't.
Well, Ed, you're alive. I thought you were just killed.
Yeah, it turns out it was all a package of sound effects. For one thing, horse-owning tribes like the Comanche could start migrating with the buffalo herd, so they could benefit from more of the things that buffalo gave them, i.e. everything. In a treeless, featureless prairie, they created shelter from their hides and bones, used buffalo dung for light, heat, and to cook. Every part of the buffalo was used, with buffalo bits turned into water canteens, weapons, tools, and tack, i.e. horsey equipment like saddles and bridles. Their liver and gallbladders were a treat for Comanche kids.
Yay! Buffalo waffle!
And their warm blood was mixed with milk as a nutritious beverage. Ironically, the Comanche turned their nose up at fish, which they thought was rank.
Well, horses for courses.
Ah, although the horse became commodity number one in Comanche society, it could often be eaten in desperate times, with its blood being drawn as a meal on the go as it was being ridden. Ow. Much more importantly, the horse itself was a very tradable commodity, giving the Comanche a new source of wealth and status.
That's what I think when I think of the Native American Indians. Braves riding around on horses all day, dancing like no one's watching. It's not like you see them clock watching at the office. God, grumble, grumble, something about capitalism.
Ah, but that's the irony. You see, Native Americans were actually doing much more of that mundane farming before the introduction of the horse. Horses actually had the effect of deterring Native peoples from bothering with agriculture. Horses were like their gold rush. Why farm when you could hunt buffalo? Why grow crops when you could trade horses? Not only could horses be bred or caught, then traded and or eaten, but it also left you mobile and a lot safer. If you set up a farm, you were a sitting duck for raids, but if you kept moving on your horse, no one could catch you. So the tribes you've probably heard of are the tribes that went horse crazy. The Sioux, the Cheyenne, Kiowa, Arapaho, Blackfoot and Crow. But no one, and we mean no one, took to the horse like the Comanche. Comanche kids, both girls and boys, were given their first horse aged 4. One of their early classes was learning to pick things up from the ground mid-gallop. And yes, this was about picking up fallen comrades, but it also taught them a circus-like level of dexterity on a horse. They went crazy for horses.
Crazy for horses!
When fighting Europeans armed with guns, the Comanche could slide down the side of their horse to protect their own bodies while still riding and firing off arrows. In fact, a Comanche warrior could fire 20 arrows from horseback in the time it took a US regular soldier to load and fire their musket just one time. The Comanche warrior carried a bow, arrow, shield, and a 14-foot lance. They were deadly, both in close combat and at a range of 30 feet. 19th century US Army officer Colonel Richard Dodge called them
the finest light cavalry in the world. But why didn't other Native American peoples do this also?
Well, there's probably no clear answer here. Certainly in raising the fortunes of the Comanche, the horse became absolutely central to their existence, and they in turn lived and breathed horses, having their own words for every conceivable shade of horse, and even different names for the varying ear shapes. When Victorian anthropologists first met the Comanche, they estimated that these people must have had horses for thousands of years. So central were they to the culture. But they didn't even realise that they'd only had horses for hundreds of years at most.
But surely, Ed, Victorian anthropologists knew that all horses came over with the Spanish.
Well, apparently not, Phil. I mean, that said, Victorian anthropologists believe that Caucasians were the most highly evolved human beings of all.
But we burn in the sun on cloudy days.
Yeah, it's like we're not adapted for this planet at all. But the Comanche did one thing with the horse that no other tribe managed. They bred them. Again, this was a highly skilled, intensive practice, and the Comanche copied the Spanish here. But this meant that they could own huge stocks of horses and trade them with other tribes, making themselves extremely rich and powerful in the process. Being able to use horses allowed them to migrate south with the buffalo and challenge other tribes for domination. And not only were they breeding horses, they were catching them too. Here's how Comanches caught horses. Number 1.
Lasso horse.
Number 2.
Choke it until near death.
Number 3.
Stroke horse's nose, ears and forehead.
Number 4.
Put own mouth over horse's nostrils and blow in air.
Number 5.
Throw thong over horse's jaw, mount up, and ride off.
Presumably, while the horse was still thinking, what the foal just happened? Horses meant wealth. A Comanche warrior could have as many as 200 mounts, which was quite the status symbol.
How many Comanches were there?
Actually, only about 20,000. I mean, that seems like an absurdly small number to control such a huge stretch of land. Partly this is because the Comanche live sparsely, as hunter-gatherers tend to do, and most of the territory they lorded over was populated by other people. And, of course, infant mortality was presumably high too. But one of the major problems the Comanche had was low fertility, specifically miscarriages.
Yeah, but why did the Comanche miscarry so often?
Okay, this is going to sound nuts, but as far as my reading goes, this is actually very accurate. Apparently, spending a totally mobile nomadic life bouncing up and down on horseback, not great for pregnancies. The Comanche solution was to...
stop having pregnant women bouncing around on horses?
No, the kidnapping of other women.
That's the second.
That's the one I would go for. It just seems more likely. For the most part, this was women from other tribes, but as the Comanche made contact with Europeans, they tended to kidnap European women too, which didn't make them extremely popular. Typically in these raids, the men, elderly, older children would be killed, often after torture. The women and young children would typically be spared as useful new recruits or breeders of new recruits for the Comanche nation. Not babies, though. Babies were seen as a burden and would typically be killed too.
Yeah, that's a pretty difficult sell for the Comanche PR agency. Never kill babies, is my advice.
Yeah. There are accounts of European women being captured by the Comanche and undergoing a grueling ordeal. Gang rape and beatings were the norm. If the unlucky women survived, they were then put to work as little more than slaves, usually being forced to work on a quota of hides to generate more wealth for the tribes. While Comanche women could have some degree of freedom, whether that was being allowed horse ownership or expected to fight with the men, there's no female suffrage here. In fact, women were specifically forbidden from attending councils. And like in many societies, having lots of wives was a status symbol. Ironically, many American settlers admired the Comanche as being truly free. No government, no taxes, total freedom. But they obviously weren't factoring in the women here, whose life was work, herding, skinning, butchering, tanning, making clothes, repairing teepees, bringing up kids. And all this was before morning coffee. Now, although the darker side of Comanche culture might make us wince, the Comanche thought there was nothing much wrong with what they did. We've said before the Comanche didn't have a religious structure, but that's not to say that they weren't deeply religious people. They believed that the spirits were everywhere, in rocks and animals and everything else. But as far as we know, they didn't seem to have our Judeo-Christian tradition of good and evil.
Yes, exactly, exactly. We, as Judeo-Christians, we know good from evil.
We do, yeah.
For example, Bloody Crusades, good, right?
Absolutely, truly good. If the Comanche caught someone from a hostile tribe, they would torture them to death and were said to have taken great pleasure in it. But likewise, the Comanche expected exactly the same fortune if the same happened to them. So masochists, yes. Hypocrites, no. The Daily Mail would have loved them.
So, psychopaths much?
Well, maybe. I'm not going to hand wave away gang rape and baby murdering because it's obviously totally messed up no matter what time you're in or what place you are. But at the same time, I'm not going to say, hey, that's just their culture either.
We at CTDA believe that sexual assault and baby murder are bad things.
However, just because they seem to accept these things as part of their culture, we'd be wrong to characterise the Comanche as cold-blooded, joyless nutcases. This would also be to fly in the face of a lot of good evidence to the contrary. Western observers who spent time with them often painted a very different picture of the intimate life of the Comanche. Colonel Richard Dodge described the Comanche as joyful, cheerful, and lovers of practical jokes. They sang all day, danced, took any excuse to gamble on literally anything, and race horses. They also loved gossip, personal grooming, and they doted on their families. And while becoming a hostage of the Comanche was definitely something to avoid, there was such thing as loved captives. For example, Cynthia Ann Parker was captured aged 9 and was with the Comanche for 24 years, during which time she was, by her own account, in a loving marriage, had 3 children and forgot how to speak English. And several times when people came looking for her to bring her back to civilization, she flat out refused. And when they offered the band she was with untold wealth and riches for her return, they refused too. And that was remarkable, since much of the Comanches' wealth came from taking hostages in exchange for ransoms. And the story of Cynthia Ann is by no means singular. There are various accounts of young girls being taken, adopted, and treated like beloved daughters, often before being ransomed totally unscathed. Some of these former captives became the Comanches' fiercest advocates and defenders. And actually, when these women arrived back in Victorian society, they were often shunned and ignored, mainly because they were suspected of having had sex with filthy pagans. Victorian morality, Eddie. Best in the world.
Best in the world.
So, hopefully, I've made the case that Comanche morality was, at best, complicated. Yes, the Comanche were brutal, but the American Plains were also brutal. European wars were usually fight until one side gives up. Plains Indian wars were fight until the death. So the Comanche took the same attitude whether they were fighting the Apache or raiding a settlement of Scottish Presbyterians. It really made no difference to them. Their brutality seemed shocking to the average white settler, but was business as usual for the Comanche. And maybe that brutality kept them free. That brutality had kept them feared. It also kept the Spanish at bay. Since the conquistadors had pulled up on ships, the Spanish had had a relatively easy time of wiping out the native people of South and Central America through disease, warfare, and then enslaving and Christianizing them, lucky people. The first people who had really offered serious resistance were the Apache, whose lightning attacks were bleeding the Spanish dry. But then, one day in 1720, the Spanish peeked out of their heavily fortified missions to discover the Apache turning up and asking for their protection. And while their first reaction was,
"Jesus has brought the pagans unto us. It's a miracle."
The Apache pointed out that the protection they sought was from a terrifying new threat from the north. The Apache, who fought on foot and had permanent settlements, were no match for these demonic, black-faced, mounted raiders. The problem for the Apache and the Spanish was that the Comanche had a raiding range of 400 miles. The Comanche drew out maps that their warriors could commit to memory, navigating their way from the memory of something sketched out in sand. That's incredible to me. Phil, I mean, like, in the morning, how do you get from your bedroom to, like, the kitchen?
Oh, hold on. I just need to load up Google Maps.
Exactly.
Should I take the tube or should I cycle?
I mean, isn't it? It's first left, isn't it, after your toilet? I don't know.
I don't know. I need to check Google Maps.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
My point.
Well, okay. Well, just let me know. Would you text me when you find out how to get to your kitchen, mate? Is that right?
Yeah, I'll share the route.
Yeah, share the route. Yeah, exactly.
All right.
All right. All right. All right. Okay. Cheers, mate. Okay. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
When raids happened on the Spanish, they generally put together a revenge party who generally venture out and kill the first group of Indians that came to hand. And by the way, I'm saying Indians as the Spanish would see it, i.e. we don't know where we are, we think this is India. But generally speaking, the Spanish were being bled white by the Comanche raids. In fact, the Comanche was such a big problem for the Spanish that they eventually recognised Comancheria and even started to realise that it might make a useful buffer against French and English expansion. Things finally stabilised when Governor of New Mexico, Don Juan Bautista, had enough success in an ambush against the Comanche for them to grudgingly respect him. Now, rather than trying to follow up his success with more victories, he instead offered them peace, recognised their lands, and didn't try to convert them to Catholicism, which the Comanche had no time for. He also offered them a lucrative trade, using middlemen traders called Comancheros. These Comancheros operated at the fringe of both societies. They were half Spanish, half native. They traded like the Spanish, but could navigate like natives. They were the perfect go-between. And amazingly, this peace actually held in place. Now, had Spanish authority lasted in this part of the world, maybe some kind of long-term peace could have held. After all, the Spanish didn't think Comanche lands were worth the trouble. They certainly had no intention of trying to settle the area, and even their Mexican successors, who got their independence from Spain in 1821, were far more occupied with internal issues in their new state. But in 1836, when Texas became independent from Mexico, things changed dramatically. Da, da, da. I said dramatically.
Oh, sorry.
The Texans had no intention of leaving these Comanches be. They had every intention of clearing out these troublesome Indians and expanding the Republic of Texas all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Now, although extremely keen to expand at everybody else's expense, not absolutely all Texans were hostile to the Comanche. In fact, Sam Houston, 2 times president of Texas and many times alcoholic, was actually quite pro-Comanche and often took their part in settlement disputes against his own citizens. In years to come, the Comanche would often appeal to Houston, asking why the Texans wouldn't just paint a line and stay behind it. Houston replied,
"If I could build a wall from the Red River to the Rio Canada so high that no Indian could scale it, the white people would go crazy trying to devise a means to get beyond it."
Unfortunately, Houston was probably right, since the Texas Congress then voted that all Indian land should be open to white settlement. And as Texan and American settlers encroached further into Comanche land, so Comanche attacks increased on those same settlers. Over the course of 2 years, 100 captives were taken. Doubling down on this, Houston's successor, Mirabeau Lamar, moved Texas's capital from Houston to Waterloo in 1839, right on the border of Comanche lands.
Waterloo, Texas not found.
Sorry, Ed, since I know it's been since season one, but I must have accidentally plugged the Mappatron back in.
Oh, not that again. And I can't believe, I can't believe that Mappatron's been listening the whole time. It's worse than Google Assistant.
Waterloo, Texas, not found.
Actually, they renamed it Austin, Texas now.
Waterloo, I must have defeated you on the wall.
Phil, turn it off, please.
Haven't you heard of ABBA Voyage? We could charge for this.
Yeah, finally we make some money. As another map-based fact, Houston, Texas was named after Sam Houston, who
makes sense.
Mirabeau Lamar actually hated. So he seemed to be sticking it to Houston's legacy on two fronts. Firstly, by taking the capital and moving it, and then by overriding Houston's Comanche policy. See, Lamar wasn't dead keen on Native Americans either, calling on their extermination so that the Republic of Texas could be extended west to the Pacific Ocean. The Texas Congress loved the sound of this so much that they voted him a large war chest to make this happen. It's only fair to point out that Texas's hostility officially differed from the policy of the US government, who, in 1825, had voted through the creation of Indian Country, a protected land that Secretary of War James Barber said would ensure that
the future residences of these peoples will remain undisturbed.
And was it?
Well, that permanently undisturbed land is now known as Oklahoma.
What? You mean that the US government didn't honour their agreements with the Native Americans?
Put it like this, Phil. Did the US government honour the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty with the Sioux?
No.
You're right. It was no.
Yes.
Ignoring US government rhetoric, Lamar trummed up 2,000 Indian hunters to go to war, and then they had to employ some Indian scouts to actually track the Indians they were hunting, because the Texans couldn't actually find any Indians, let alone kill them without native trackers. I love the idea of these Indian hunters going, "That's right, we're going to hunt some Indians, but first we're going to employ some Indians to help us hunt the Indians, guys." Their first target was the Cherokee, who had actually been Europeanizing, trading with Texas, and now lived in settled villages. But this wasn't going to satisfy the bloodlust of the Indian hunters. And it was claimed that the Cherokee were working with Mexico to betray Texas. I mean, absolute hogwash, of course, but the Congress of Texas liked the sound of it and justified all that slaughter. The same fate befell largely peaceful tribes such as the Delaware, Shawnee, and Creek Indians. Tribes like the Alabamas were spared, but only on the understanding that they'd departed their fertile lands and moved to decidedly less fertile land. By the way, Phil, if you know where Alabama is, you know it's not exactly in Texas. Which sort of suggests how far the Alabama were moved from the place they grew up.
Well, we attack those natives.
We attack those natives.
Because we wanted their farming ground. Cause the southern brand don't need them around. Need them around. Shit, home for Alabama. We're nothing else grew. Shit, home for Alabama. Lord, we'll take what's meant for you.
So, by deportation or murder, Texas was freeing up thousands of acres of excellent farmland, ripe and ready for wholesome Christian homesteads in East Texas. Flush with victory, the Texans lengthened their gaze west to Comanche lands. Now, it's one thing to attack and burn a helpless village. It's quite another to go toe-to-toe with the best light cavalry in the world. And it seemed that just for a moment, the Indian hunters lost their enthusiasm.
Let's get them redskins.
Why, certainly. After you.
Ho, no, sir. I couldn't possibly.
Oh, come.
Ho, no, sir. I must insist. Ed, that must be where the Texans get their famous good manners from.
That's right, from being yeller. Don't at me, American listeners. But this hesitation wouldn't last. Not only were the Comanche lands too big a prize to be ignored, but the Comanche acts of raiding, killing, and taking hostages were too good a recruiting sergeant for morally outraged Texans. But let's be honest, even if the Comanches' worst crimes were village fetes and tea parties, the Texan Congress would have cooked up some reason or other why the Comanche definitely shouldn't have their land anymore. The Comanche had never faced such a foe as they found in the Texans. The Spanish would rather make a deal than commit forces to quell the rampaging Comanche. The Mexicans simply had their own problems to deal with, but the Texans considered everything around them their new home and ultimate destiny. They weren't going anywhere, and they were tough, grizzled, and probably didn't travel with wash bags.
Oh yes, I don't feel right unless my toothy pegs get a good clean.
This was a clash of cultures, and to find out what happened and how it turned out, you'll have to join us in part two.
Yes, yes. Or you could look it up online.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, that's why I said could, but shouldn't. Don't do it.
Good idea, Phil. Anyway, join us next time on Countries That Don't Exist More.
Hey, humans, this Stone Age band, cross the land.
sisters. Hope you enjoyed that part one of Comancheria. Join us again for part two. And as usual, if you want a ton of extras, go to our website, ctdeapod.com. We're on the socials, Twitter, ctdeapod, and Facebook. Who uses Facebook? Some people apparently, I don't know, old. If you're old, join us on Facebook. And of course, we have a Patreon, and we'd be very, very appreciative for your generous benefactoring. Patreon.com/ctdeapod. Lots of awards and special things and treats and bonuses and everything you could possibly want your heart's desired content to think. Those aren't words, but there will be more words next time on...
Countries that don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist.